This podcast is brought to you by the Legarten Institute. I'm Sianne Hansen, Executive Director, and we hope you enjoy this conversation.
I am Anne Applebaum. I'm the director of the Transitions Forum at the Legatum Institute, and I'm really pleased today to be talking to Garry Kasparov, a great chess champion and the author of Winter is Coming, a book about his life and about, more importantly, about contemporary Russia. Hello, Garry. Thanks for coming to London.
Thanks for inviting me.
Thanks. One of the most interesting things about your book, among many interesting things, is the autobiographical element. Could you talk a little bit about your decision to move from chess into politics? Because I think for a lot of people that was not an obvious move.
As a professional chess player in the Soviet Union, so I couldn't avoid politics.
Right, of course.
The way it was handled in the Soviet Union, because to become the world champion, I mean, you had to go through many hurdles, not only at the chessboard. And when I won the title in 1985, it was the first year of Gorbachev's rule, the beginning of changes in the Soviet Union, so-called perestroika. I felt very strongly that it was my duty as one of the most popular names in the former Soviet Union to be involved. So I was young, you know, idealistic, but I felt very strongly that it was time for change and I could make my own contribution. I've been actively engaged in the democratic movement in the late 80s and early 90s, but after August 91, I thought it was over. So I don't think, you know, I was the only one who made this mistake. So it's in August 91 to imagine that 9 years later, KGB Lieutenant Colonel would be promoted to the presidency of Russia. It was unthinkable. I had a couple of other engagements with Russian politics under Yeltsin, but I was still, you know, playing professionally. It's in 93, a bit more in 96, you know, with Yeltsin's re-election campaign. But again, I could hardly imagine that we would be facing not just problems on the way to the civilized democratic society, but actually a successful attempt to turn back the clock and to push Russia back to the past, or actually just to the, some kind of, not maybe past, but the sideline of the civilized world, and to turn new Russian state into a main threat to the world. And in 2005, I left professional chess. It was not a spontaneous decision. I've been thinking about it for a while because I always wanted to make the difference in my life, and I realized that at a certain point I will have to do something else. And I had other plans, so I was about to release my new book, How Life Imitates Chess, about strategy, decision making. But at the same time, I thought that it would be my duty as a Russian citizen and someone who gained sort of international notoriety to address Russian public about the dangers of Putin's regime. Unfortunately, it was not yet obvious both in Russia or outside of Russia. And our warnings, coming from myself and my allies and colleagues in Russia, and a few of them in the West, they were not received seriously. So for many years, I've been preaching in the desert. So people didn't want to see that was obvious.
This is interesting. We were just talking about this. What did you see in 2005 and 2006? What were the elements? Because I was writing about Russia at the same time, and I also was described as a kind of, you know, crazy cold warrior. What did you see then?
No, I saw it even before 2005. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the first thing Putin did after being sworn to the Russian presidency, he restored the Soviet anthem. Mm-hmm. That for people who were born and raised in the Soviet Union, that was a clear signal about his sort of historical preferences, you know, where it's about his allegiance. And I couldn't be quiet when I just heard him saying that, you know, KGB officers will always KGB officers. That was even before he became president. So Putin's KGB roots, they were not just, you know, not a mere formality. So it's, he made it very clear that he would keep the allegiance to this organization and to the values of this organization. And then we had apartment bombings. Second Chechen War, the oldest brutalities, carpet bombing, Nordost, Beslan. There was enough, you know, in his credit history before 2005, I mean, to understand where was where we were heading. I was quite shocked to see that the Western leaders, they tried to sort of set it aside as irrelevant problems that could not sort of mar the big picture of Russia joining the family of leading world democracies. In 2006, the one that the summit in St. Petersburg, I think it was the one of the turning points where Putin was a host of the meeting of G7.
G7.
And this meeting basically killed any attempt in Russia, inside Russia, to communicate this message to Russian Russian public that Putin is a dictator to be. So that's because who is Garry Kasparov and all other people, you know, shouting that Putin is dangerous. Look, you know, we elections being rigged and as we're moving, you know, just the wrong direction. When you have Putin smiling, surrounded by Bush, Berlusconi, Chirac, Blair, they're all there. And I cannot blame an average Russian citizen. Just look at this picture and come on, they know better. I mean, it says, yes, you have an opposition, but these guys have a bitter views about Putin. And at the same time, look, you know, maybe we have some problems with democracy, but living standards steadily improving. Russia was embraced by the greatest democracies in the world, and Putin looks, you know, very different from the old Soviet leaders. So Putin's propaganda machine acted very efficiently, and we have to give them credit for just playing all these, you know, cards building Putin's image that was so different from his real intentions. And I think that it's if these warnings were heard at that time, maybe Russia had a chance in 2007 so to move away from this dangerous path, because I think Putin could still be, not persuaded, but there was a chance for him to walk away, just to buy International Olympic Committee, just to do something else. So just to walk away from Russian, I would say government, but it's basically he was calling all the shots. Mm-hmm. And to hand it over to Medvedev or whoever. Not that I like Medvedev or just, you know, any of Putin's potential nominees, but I think without Putin, Russia still had maybe a slight chance of just returning to this to the mainstream road. But when Putin stayed, you know, behind the curtain, you know, as a prime minister, I knew it was over. So it would be a dictatorship, because, you know, it was just a timeout. But he would come back, and when he did it in 2012, you know, it's. Even for those who had doubts, you know, it became quite apparent that we are talking about Putin for life.
Since 2012, he's been quite a different leader, I think, than he was in the first 10 years, partly because Russia is not growing economically anymore. And there's a, you know, this promise to Russians, okay, maybe I'm not a Democrat, but at least your living standards are going up. That's had to come to an end. Do you think you think he's offering Russians something else now?
But I don't think it's just about, you know, the problems with economy, because I think it's more philosophical. The problem with any dictator, mm-hmm. at certain point, dictatorship reaches its peak. It's in Venice, but it runs out of steam, because dictatorships cannot grow economically. They don't offer new ideas. They don't have this public engaged in economy, in innovation. So they could make a push, but then it stops. And a dictator who, in the beginning, you know, looks like, you know, a reformer, an innovator, and who is looking for friends inside and outside of the country, he has no choice but to start looking for enemies. Because you have to find an argument why you stay in power for so long and with no intentions to leave. Economic arguments and smiles always replace the history by repressions and search for enemies. And Putin is a great expert in creating enemies. So that's why it was quite a natural pass for Putin's dictatorship to look for enemies everywhere and to present him as the only protector of Mother Russia against numerous enemies surrounding us everywhere. Okay, just by the whole perimeter of vast Russian territory. Mm-hmm.
And do you think, you know, you live in New York now and you travel a lot in the West, meet all kinds of people. Do you think that that it's begun to sink in that he's a different kind of leader? Do you think we understand it now or not really?
I think in the last few days, actually, we saw quite a dramatic change because
this is Syria.
Yes, it's Syria. It's not that we didn't have all the signs on the wall, but I think as before Syria, many people didn't want to see it. Even Ukraine, you know, there was still kind of argument, not valid, but it's like self-protection. You know, intellectual people want to protect themselves against recognizing the obvious fact. Putin is not just a dictator who is the menace to Russia and to people in Russia. This is the man who can threaten the entire world, and he will not stop short of doing the most heinous things, you know, attacking any enemy if he would think it could help him to stay in power for an extra day. Ukraine, it was just the first violation of territorial integrity of European countries since 1945, and not that Putin got away with that, but there were still arguments that, okay, former Soviet Union.
Well, it's his natural territory.
Maybe it's his natural habitat. So yeah. Now, Syria, it hasn't changed anything, you know, strategically, because we knew, you know, it was coming. But for many, if not for all, you know, it demonstrated that you couldn't pretend Putin would be just sitting in this. In his former Soviet corners, you know, without spreading his influence, his destructive influence around the world.
Is there something you can recommend? I mean, what would you like to see change in Western policy towards Russia?
Everything. It has to be reversed 180 degrees. It's more philosophical rather than just tactical. Putin can be pushed back only by strength. And that's again another lesson from history. 7 years of appeasement of Obama administration, you know, reset policy, which rewarded Putin for his aggression against Georgia. We just didn't even mention that. So that, you know, created a sense of impunity. Putin believes that he could do whatever, and the U.S. administration will not act. 15 years of staying in power convinced Putin that the West, we know it's typical for democracy to always offer benefits of the doubts, to just to look for an opportunity to find a compromise. But from the Putin's point of view, as every thug and mafia boss, he saw it and he keeps seeing it as a weakness. And as long as he believes that he can get away with his brazen actions, he would go anywhere in the world. I think we should just recognize a simple fact. The longer Putin stays in power in Russia, so less are the chances for Russia to recover from this disastrous rule, and high is the risk of a global conflict. Putin is a lost cause, and some of the people from his inner circle, they also have burned all the bridges. But there's still a vast, or just, you know, sizable element of Russian elite. that could expect, you know, just a better future. So they are not, they do not want to be on the same sinking ship. The only way they can rise against Putin, the only way that something will happen in Russia, is that if Putin is defeated in Ukraine, Syria, anywhere where he goes. The way to bring down the dictator is to show to the influential people inside Russia that he is not invincible. He has weaknesses, and the West is willing to take whatever to make all the steps, whatever it takes, to go after him and to prevent him from spreading this, you know, virus of dictatorship around the world.
Thanks, Gary. Thank you for coming to London.
Thank you.
To hear more podcasts from the Legatum Institute, please visit our iTunes channel or website at www.li.com.